We hear a lot about the impact artificial intelligence will have on our lives. To kick off an ongoing series on the impact of AI, I'm joined by Professor Bill Murphy. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Bill, artificial intelligence has actually had a very early start that I myself didn't know until we talked about it right before starting this recording. How far back does the concept of artificial intelligence go?
AJ, if we substitute machine decision-making for the term artificial intelligence, we can see that it has a long history. It's gone through periods of enthusiasm. It has been successful, and it also has lost interest in the investing and using public and in the minds of people. In fact, the techniques of mass production that underlay the Industrial Revolution that replaced the Agricultural Revolution can all be traced back to essentially increasing amounts of decision-making made by machines, the machines on the assembly line, that were substituting for what used to be done by hand by humans. So a drill press will keep drilling the same hole at the same depth in the same spot, machine after machine after machine to be assembled into a car, as opposed to having a craftsperson drilling that hole. Hopefully it's made the same way and so on. And we see today the descendants of that this machine decision-making ancestors in the welding robots. You see the pictures of the factory with nobody there, and the welding robots are happily welding away. If we look at those decision-making made by those machines, it really is different than what we think of today as artificial intelligence, because it really did not involve the computers and the computer mind. It was right. Essentially built into the machines. And if we look at the Jacquard looms that were used as part of the Industrial Revolution, and here we are on the Merrimack River Valley, and Manchester Mills would have these looms. They would have these wooden carts with holes punched in them that would be chained together, that would feed the machine and had the instructions as to what the patterns would be. And it would print out the different patterns, replacing skilled craftspeople. But it made the same pattern every time. And it made it cheaply. And it could run 24/7. So we see that that type of intelligence, minimal as it was intelligence that had to come from a human, now was incorporated into a machine. Sometimes it was the structure of the machine itself. You think of almost any manufacturing jig. I'm going to make the gun barrel the same length. I have a jig set up that's going to cut it the same way every time. In the past, the skilled craftsperson would measure it individually, every one. It wasn't really until much later, when we got to the computers, that people started talking about intelligence, that, that somehow this had more intelligence. But I think we always want to embody inanimate objects with an intelligence they don't have.
Yeah, because I mean, it wasn't until like the last, 80 years that silicon is involved into it, and then you're getting into actual we today call computers. But I mean, early day manufacturing is essentially the same thing. You're programming the, instead of ones and zeros, holes and no holes, and that would tell the computer to do what you want it to do.
I mean, you can think of a player piano. I mean, essentially that's a code. Little holes that a vacuum senses and depresses the keys and plays better than I could play the piano. I remember as a kid, I always liked to stand next to the or sit next to the piano and pretend I was playing because it always played in a much more elaborate fashion than I could. No computer involved, but it did have sort of the rudiments. There's a code. There's a way of imparting that code into the machine. Now, a human wrote the code.
Right.
You might say the intelligence was from somebody who originally wrote down, that's the hole for that note, that's the right note.
In modern times, I mean, we entirely consider the concept of artificial intelligence to be utilized by computers, where in theory, it's creating some of the work. It's completing some of the work on its own without necessarily that person telling it to do this or not do this. At what point does that start entering the mainstream?
I mean, really post-World War II, with the invention of electronic computers, even though computers had been predicted before and there were, you know, the mechanical Turing machines and so on, it wasn't really the electronic computers that have made this all possible. And I think in World War II, We have the original tube-driven computers. And in fact, my mom worked for UNIVAC. I have a tube from UNIVAC 2, which, you know, it's like, okay, this was what now is a sub-microscopic chip of a transistor on a chip. And this is a giant tube that's just one, you know, on-off switch, essentially. And, you know, think about how hot that was and how much power that took. These things weren't very powerful. But even though that when they came out, even though they weren't very powerful, there was a lot of enthusiasm right after World War II that these can solve problems we couldn't solve before. We see that MIT and a number of research libraries, particularly MIT, because they had the artificial intelligence lab that was founded in 1959, driven by our concerns of the Cold War. I mean, we have to launch ballistic missiles. We're trying to go into space. These things require computation and decision-making that really was pushing the limits of any individual humans to try to get their heads around. And we saw that each year, the computers are getting faster, cheaper, and more capable. Part of it's also we learned better techniques. We learned how to program them better. You know, we didn't have to write the machine language. We had, you know, higher level languages and compilers and so on that we could do that. And sometimes the same hype you hear today, you would have heard back then. There's a famous professor, Marvin Minsky, who was the co-founder of MIT's AI laboratory, which was founded in 1959 as the AI Project. And he said in an interview in Life magazine, if you remember what that was, in 1959, he said, 3 to 8 years from now, we will have a machine with general intelligence of an average human being. Well, he was wrong. He was very intelligent. He was very far-reaching on many thoughts, but this one was just not correct. But we did start seeing things that hinted at what the potential was. And I remember we had talked about this. I asked you if you remember the Eliza computer psychotherapist that was popular. I remember when I was younger, in the mid-60s, that you would query it with questions and then it would ask questions back. Yes. And it acted like a psychotherapist. So you'd say, well, how are you feeling today? I'm not feeling so good. Why do you say you're not feeling so good?
Yeah, it's a branching functionality.
Yeah, so and that was the way it worked.
Right.
It's sort of an early expert system, but the stuff was all kind of rote. And a lot of people said, oh, this was helpful. You know, it's just the machine was listening to them. The machine wasn't doing anything of the sort. There truly wasn't any intelligence. It was sort of mimicking aspects of human intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm 32, so growing up, I was at the peak AOL Instant Messenger days where there are bots you could just like, oh, I wonder what it could send me, or you receive random chats like, this isn't a real person. Something's not quite right, but it would reply to you. And it was fascinating to play around with it. Yeah, so what was the next phase going on, expanding from like the Eliza or just the basic branching functionality?
Well, in the 1980s, computers had reached a speed, cost, and functionality point that, which was coupled with advances in programming, that led to another wave of interest in what was labeled even then as artificial intelligence. It also attracted funding from then what was new, the DARPA funding for the government. And here the real push was on expert systems. We're going to take the expertise of someone and put it into these computer programs. Not terribly different than what we did with the Jacquard loom. We take the expertise of a master, you know, embroiderer and put it on those cards or the player piano card. But we're going to have the computer do it and have much more flexibility and maybe be a little more flexible. And this was very, very popular in the investment community. There was funding available, some of it from the government, but also from private investors. And there were two major spinoffs from the MIT AI lab, the artificial intelligence lab, Lisp Machines in 1979, and then Symbolics in 1980. And if you want to know a little side story, Symbolics.com was the first company to register a domain name in what was the internet in 19, 85. This is pre-World Wide Web internet.
Wow.
So, you know, this is early days when they did it. And another interesting side story with these two, they both went bankrupt in the 90s.
You mean there wasn't a ton of money in this yet?
There was a ton of money, but it didn't last. The money never lasts. So.
No.
And this another side story is that these two companies got involved in a serious copyright licensing dispute. So tie into our, the law makes a difference, intellectual property dispute, caused these two to look for proprietary ways of owning the technology that they're working on. And it's interesting, there was another person at the MIT AI lab, Richard Stallman, who has spoken here in years past, and he saw this as a problem and he developed the new operating system, GNU, and he started the Free Software Foundation in the 80s in response to that. He thought this was not the way to go, and we can trace the open source software movement and the new, now Linux, operating system to the dysfunctionality he saw of them fighting over this technology. By the time we get to this 80s wave, expert systems were useful in some aspects. We can see evidence of this in some of the products used today. TurboTax is really an expert system. It replaced a basic accountant who tells you what the law means and what the IRS regs mean, and you fill it out. But it's a basic tree, very complex piece of software. But you know, that's an expert system that was programmed with the expertise. The software doesn't learn
right
what the code is. Somebody puts the code in, and it doesn't self-learn in any ways. Probably one of the end point of that 80s era was the Japanese fifth generation project. In 1982, they started an effort, and they were going to, you know, essentially make machines that were truly intelligent. And this scared the United States because they were using this in manufacturing, the last generation, to make the robots and all that, you know, robotic manufacturing of automobiles that were making cheap cars that were killing the American auto industry at the time. And we even had an effort, the American Reaction, the Microelectronics and Computer Technology Corporation, which I got to study while it was still going, while I was working on my doctorate. Problem was, by 1992, it was clear that the technologies that they were chasing down weren't going to work. You know, that wasn't the right path. And so we had another, what they call AI winter, that you know, the funding dries up, it's not solving the problems any more than the ones that it had solved, and that's where it sort of stayed for a while. The last evidence of this sort of, well, just put in enough expertise and use brute force, and that's the way we would get better and better, was probably Deep Blue playing chess in 1997. Essentially, that was a deep, you know, a brute force approach to solving the problem. I know all the alternatives, right, and I'll just run through them as fast as I can with the biggest computer I can handle. It's so different than the way when we had the computer beat Go a few years later of how that learned. It came up with strategies that nobody even knew about.
Yeah,
no expert have ever done.
Yeah, that's really the next step. Is it's moving from just, oh, the programmer said, okay, you need to do this. If this happens, do this. If this happens, do this. It's just kind of basic computer programming with a lot of it. And then the next step really is where the computer is taking command of, okay, I'm this is my mission that's been given to me by my programmer or the operator, and it takes it from there.
Yeah, you see, when you even the way you speak, you're adding into it's a human. This is what we like.
Yeah,
we
know, right?
We like them to be human.
We anthropomorphize the AI just like we do anything else.
If it acts anywhere like a human, it's alive.
Yes.
I think that's the real key for the latest AI wave, and that's why we're all talking about it. That's why we're talking about it today. This wave is different. It's not just the computers got faster and so on. We have come up with a new technique, and the technique is based on data. The deep
learning.
We're
kind of at a place where we can, because I mean, the storage mechanisms were so tough to manage back in the day, or just straight up didn't exist.
And to access them, I mean, right. It would be very difficult. So, Google has tons of, and why do you think they own a deep learning company that does a lot of AI? Because they happen to have a lot of data.
Yeah.
And Amazon you use Web that Services, data to teach
Facebook.
Your machine.
Yeah.
One of the earlier examples of this, they had a lot of trouble. Because I remember I was doing my research on the MCC, which is the Microcomputer and Technology Corporation back in Austin, back in the 80s. They had a lot of trouble having computers recognize speech. Because it would always translate as, recognize speech or some, because, people talk a little bit loosely. It was Dragon Systems that started, really getting good computer recognition for, that could run on our machines. We didn't have to have massive machines and so on. And Google really figured out that, by using deep learning, by looking at data of how people spoke actually. That's why if you use your voice recognition software, which I just love today, it's pretty accurate. But if you just try one word, it's not.
Right.
If you give it a phrase, it puts it in context because it's looking at.
Contextual awareness was the big shift.
Yeah.
I mean, you see this especially with Google's operating system, the Android, where it understands context and will continue that conversation once again. Kind of that anthropomorphization of like, this feels like I'm talking to a person and you interface with the computer as such.
And think of Google Translates now. So we move to the next step. Not only can I talk to it, but then I can say and spit it back in German. Yeah. But where'd they get that? Well, they had all these UN documents that had both the English and the German or the English and the French. And they could say, that phrase in English is X and this phrase is the comparable one. Now, it doesn't always work. I remember Professor Orcutt and I were in Costa Rica a number of years ago, and we thought, it would be nice that we'll just put up part of one of our things.
We ran it through the Google. Live demo gods. Don't do that.
it was during a break. We thought, we'll put this up. We ran it through Google Translate Spanish, and we popped it up. And then somebody pointed out, that one word, that's not a good one. That one you shouldn't be using in the legal context that you used it. So, we're still early days, but it's so much better than it was. I mean, you could get the general idea of what was going on there. And now we are at data-driven AI that, deep learning is one of it. But we also have another technique that the machines can self-learn. Mm-hmm. We just sort of let them loose, perhaps with a goal. Here's the goal of this game.
Right.
Play the game and figure out how best to do it. And it can do that. You combine those two and you have an extremely powerful system. Right. And I think that's where we are. The technology is such that we can combine the self-learning plus the data-driven, and we have the firepower to do that. You don't need a supercomputer.
And now you got a Tesla, which basically has all the sensors, LiDAR, and cameras, and you can say, I need to go point A to B, figure it out, and it'll do it on its own. It's just fascinating.
And we're going to see that, and that's why I think it's not intelligence. I
mean, right.
Even now, people admit, the car really doesn't know much other than
knows this is the mission.
I don't hit pedestrians or something. It's not going to have a conversation with you about anything beyond that. And I think that's where we have to be careful when we want to see more in this. And then that's why we always get disappointed. Each one of these AI waves has stuck. I mean, some of it's still with us. It's not like we said, none of that worked and we went away. We incorporated the best bits of it. And then maybe we go, it didn't solve all the problems when we had to wait for the next piece of technology.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.